listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book Multipliers, How the Best Leaders Make Everyone Smarter by Liz Wiseman with Greg McKinnon and a foreword by Stephen Covey. Last show, we were beginning to look at Chapter 5, The Debate Maker. Quote, "It is better to debate a decision without settling it than settling a decision without debating it." Joseph Joubert. How leaders make decisions is profoundly influenced by how they engage and leverage the resources around them. Our research has shown that diminishers tend to make decisions solo or with a small inner circle. As a result, they not only underutilize the intelligence of those around them, they also leave the organization spinning instead of executing. Multipliers make decisions by first engaging people in debate, not only to achieve sound decisions, but also to develop collective intelligence and to ready their organizations to execute. Jonathan Akers illustrated the difference between these two approaches when he drove a high-stakes decision at a multinational software company. Jonathan Akers had recently landed a global role as vice president in corporate planning and was eager to make an impact on the business. The company was entangled in a competitive contest over ownership and mine market space. Their largest competitor dominated a small business market, while they owned the enterprise data space. In search of market control and revenue growth, this company began moving down market while their competitor was moving up. Winning the mid-market was symbolically important, but it would take an entirely new business model to get there. Jonathan had been asked to lead the development of a new pricing model to enable them to penetrate the market. It was just the opportunity he needed to deliver a tangible success. Eager to get it right on the first issue of such a strategic import, Jonathan assembled a team with all the right players, including a broad coalition of leaders from product, marketing, services, and business practices, many of whom had a deep understanding of the mid-market space. The group came together in a large conference room on the top floor of their sleek headquarters in Silicon Valley. Jonathan sat at the head of a narrow table. He began the conversation by laying out challenge to the group, teeing up the issues, and turning on the heat for the work of the task force. He made it clear that the CEO and other top lieutenants of the company were expecting significant progress in the mid-market. Driven by a high-stakes mandate, people began compiling data and analysis and submitting it to Jonathan over the course of several weeks. The task force had just been set in motion, but already it was beginning to spin with confusion. Jonathan had left unclear the role of the task force members would play, and how the recommendations and decisions would actually be made. Instead of using the brain power inherent in this high-quality task force, Jonathan used the task force as an audience for his own ideas. He consumed most of the time of the task force meeting with meetings over-articulating his own biases or dropping names. Although he gathered data from each task force member quite tenaciously, none of this information was shared or discussed in the task force meetings. There was plenty of data gathered, but there was simply no debate. The meetings atrophied into opinion-based conversation, mostly Jonathan's. One task force member shared his frustration, quote, "I came to these meetings hoping to hear from the brain trust we assembled, but all I heard was Jonathan's point of view. Although people were led to believe they would be a critical part of the decision, they quickly realized that the task force wasn't where the decision would be made, or even where it would be recommended, nor was it in a forum for debate, where their individual or collective thinking would be challenged. It appeared that the decision would be made by a select few behind closed doors. The suspicions turned out to be true. Nothing much came of their work, but it did eventually receive a sudden email from Jonathan with the subject line, quote, "Announcement of new pricing model," unquote, and knew the decision had been made completely without them. Instead of generating collective understanding and optimism about the mid-market, Jonathan generated disillusionment about the company's prospects for winning this market, and he personally earned a reputation as a time waster. The immediate impact was apparent the next time Jonathan called a task force meeting. Every other chair around the huge conference room was empty. But the more far-reaching result was that the company continued to stall in the mid-market while their competitors gained traction and additional market share. This is a story played out far beyond this top-floor conference room. It is repeated because while many leaders like Jonathan attempt the management practice of inclusion and discussion, they're still operating with an elitist view of intelligence, believing the brain power for the organization sits with a select few. They lack a rich view of intelligence in which there are many sources of insight waiting to be more fully utilized, and where intelligence actually develops through engagement and challenge. A leader's ability to garner the full intelligence of the organization depends on some of his or her most deeply held assumptions. The decision maker versus the debate maker. Mind of the multiplier. Diminishers like Jonathan Akers seem to hold an assumption that there are only a few people worth listening to. Sometimes they state that out loud, like the executive who admitted to listening to only one or two people from his 4,000-person organization. But typically, such executives manifest their assumptions in more subtle ways. They ask their direct reports to interview candidates for open positions, but they end up hiring the person from their star employee roster. They say they have an open-door policy, but seem to spend a lot of time in closed-door meetings with one or two highly influential advisors. They might patronize people by asking for their opinion, but when it comes down to the high-stakes decisions, they make them privately and announce them to the organization. Multipliers hold a very different view. They don't focus on what they know, but how to know what others know. They seem to assume that with enough minds we can figure it all out. They're interested in every relevant insight people can offer, like the executive who even late at night, after a 12-hour debate, insisted the team listen to one more comment from a junior member of the group. That comment turned out to be the critical insight necessary for solving the question at hand. It's no surprise that multipliers approach decisions by bringing people together, discovering what they know, and encouraging people to challenge and stretch each other's thinking through collective dialogue and debate. These core assumptions lie at the heart of the differences in how diminishers and multipliers make decisions. By assuming there are only a few people worth listening to, diminishers operate as decision makers. When the stakes are at their highest, they rely on their own knowledge or inner circle of people to make decisions. When multipliers are faced with a high stakes decision, they have a different gravity pull towards the full brain power of their organization. In harnessing this knowledge, they play the role of the debate maker. They realize that not all the decisions are need collective input and debate, but on the decisions of consequence, they lead rigorous debate that prosecutes the issues with hard facts and depersonalizes decisions. Through debate, they challenge and stretch what people know, thus making the organization smarter over time and creating the organizational will to execute all the decisions made. The decider versus a team of rivals. Examining the core decision-making approach of President George W. Bush and President Barack Obama reveals key differences in their stated approach to making high-stakes decisions. Mr. Bush was characterized himself as the decider, and Time magazine described him as leading the Blink presidency after Malcolm Gladwell's book Blink about the phenomena of making instantaneous decisions. In an interview with the Washington Post, writer Bob Woodworth, Mr. Bush said, quote, "I'm a gut player. I play by instincts. I don't play by the book," unquote. After writing a four-book series on the president, which included 11 hours of personal interviews with Mr. Bush, Woodworth concluded, quote, "I think Bush is impatient. I think, my summation, he doesn't like homework. And homework means reading or getting briefed or having a debate. And part of the presidency, part of the government, particularly in this area, is homework, homework, homework," unquote. We saw the consequences of rapid centralized decision making, which led the United States into the war with Iraq in 2003. Regarding the 2007 surge in Iraq, Mr. Bush asked tougher questions of his security team than he had with the original invasion because, quote, "different times call for different kinds of questions," unquote. But as a matter of record, he kept himself away from some of the meetings where key decisions about the surge were made, telling Woodward, quote, "I'm not in these meetings, you'll be happy to hear, because I've got other things to do," unquote. In contrast, Mr. Obama has stated an intent to follow Abraham Lincoln's approach to decision-making, an approach that can be summarized by the title of a book by Doris Kearns Goodwin on Lincoln, called A Team of Rivals. After introducing members of his national security team at a press conference in December 2008, which included his fierce rival in the election primaries, Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, Mr. Obama was asked how he would ensure the group worked as a team rather than as a clash of rivals. He responded with clarity. Quote, "I assembled this team because I'm a strong believer in strong personalities and strong opinions. I think this is how the best decisions are made. One of the dangers in a White House, based on my reading of history, is that you get wrapped up in groupthink. And everybody agrees with everything, and there is no decision and no dissenting views. So I'm going to be welcoming a vigorous debate inside the White House. Understand that I will be setting policy as president. I will be responsible for the vision that the team carries out, and I expect them to implement that vision once decisions are made," unquote. According to a New York Times article on March 28, 2009, Mr. Obama's stated approach to foreign policy decisions has been carried out in practice. The article outlines the debate that took place in the White House over the plan to widen the efforts being made in the Afghanistan war. Quote, "The debate over the past few weeks," wrote Helene Cooper, "offered a glimpse into how Mr. Obama makes decisions," unquote. In the end, a compromise was reached that reflected all the strains of the discussion among the advisors. David Brooks wrote about Obama's approach to foreign policy decision-making in this way. Quote, "The election revolved around passionate rallies. The Obama White House revolves around a culture of debate. He leads long analytical discussions which bring competing arguments to the fore. He sometimes seems to preside over the arguments like a judge settling a lawsuit. His policies are often a balance as he tries to accommodate different points of view. He doesn't generally issue edicts. This style has never been more evident than his decision to expand the war in Afghanistan," unquote. These two approaches capture the essence of the difference between decision makers and debate makers. History will show the long-term impact of these two approaches, but even in matters of high politics, the approach a leader takes in decision-making matters.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you're listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
Every year, countless people succumb to the temptation to purchase exotic animals like hedgehogs, lizards, monkeys, even tigers and bears to keep as pets. But life in captivity is often a death sentence for these animals, who may suffer from malnutrition, an improper environment, and the stress of confinement. For more information on this issue, visit the BCSPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book Multipliers, How the Best Leaders Make Everyone Smarter by Liz Wiseman. We're looking at the next section, The Debate Maker. Lutz Ziob, the executive at Microsoft, highlighted earlier in the book, approaches decision-making in his organization with both the mind and the practices of a debate maker. When Lutz took over the education business at Microsoft in 2003, it was a traditional education business that delivered five-day instructor-led classes through corporate training partners. But it was falling short of its goals for revenue and reach. Lutz faced a double whammy. The organization urgently needed to return to positive and profitable revenue growth, and at the same time, it needed to greatly extend its reach to ensure as many customers and potential customers as possible had a command of Microsoft's technology. As general manager of the Microsoft Learning business, Lutz needed to decide if they should look for this revenue and reach within the current base of corporate training partners, or if they should pursue a bold and potentially risky new approach in the academic sector. Lutz, who speaks with a softened German accent, has that rare combination of passion and reserve. He is a veteran of the technology education business, with a masterful command of both the strategy and the details of running his business. His team is diverse precisely because he has recruited them to be. Several are longtime Microsoft staffers. Others have a deep experience with education at other global technology firms. Several are new to their current roles because they are in stretch assignments outside their usual domain and functional expertise. After 15 minutes with Lutz, you can tell he's quite capable of making these decisions himself, given his vast knowledge. And given the stakes, many executives would have felt the pull to do so. But Lutz has a bias for debate and a conviction that more is more vital than the decision. The more rigorous and inclusive the decision-making process should be. So he set out to engage his leadership team with the challenge at hand. He gathered his team and teed up the issue with the big question. Should they refocus their entire business on the academic market, distributing education through the schools instead of through corporate training providers? Should they risk their current business model to potentially achieve a significant higher reach? He gave the team their assignments. They would meet in a couple of weeks on Orcas Island near Microsoft's headquarters in Redmond, Washington. They were to bring all the information they could gather and come with views about the academic market space. Gathered on Orcas Island, the team had the usual off-site environment, a great physical location, pens and flip charts, a big, open, light conference room. But, more important, they had been given permission to think. Because everyone was prepared, Lutz could quickly frame the issue and launch right into the challenge. Quote, as you know, the entire $300 million education business we are in has been based on a potentially outdated model. The decision we face is whether to cling to this business model or introduce a totally new model that would push the education out of the corporate classroom space and into academics, where we would reach students much earlier in their careers, unquote. He set broad parameters for debates. He insisted, I expect your best thinking here. Everyone should feel not only welcome to speak up, but there is an obligation to speak up. You can't expect us to be thorough. We will be prosecuting assumptions and asking ourselves the tough questions. Then he officially launched the first of several debates. He sparked the debate through a series of bold questions. Should we be an academic space? And what would success require? After each question, he let the team jump in and he let the debate proceed. As the discussion was beginning to reach a settling point, he pushed harder, asking people to switch sides and argue against their previously stated positions. He chimed in. Chris, switch sides with Raza. Raza, you've been for this idea. Now I want you to argue against it. Chris, you now argue for it. They would switch roles, which felt awkward for a moment or two. But soon they begin to pound the issues from the other vantage point. Or to broaden people's perspectives, he asked people to assume roles outside of their normal functional areas. Lutz persisted. Teresa, you've been offering an international perspective on this. Now look at it from the domestic point of view. And Leanne, you've been looking at the technical issues. I want you to debate this from a marketing perspective. The team stepped away from their positions and a new set of sparks erupted. Lutz loved to stir up controversy and would become noticeably disappointed if the debate wasn't charged and the sparks weren't flying. The team listened passionately to the rich and different perspectives. They challenged one another's assumptions and often their own. They happily dropped the polite professionalism that typifies so many corporate meetings and took on the challenges with an almost ferocious appetite. This was a high-stakes approach to a high-stakes decision. In the end, the organization decided that they would pursue the academic market, and they spent the next 2 years repivoting the business around students and academia. The business expanded their reach from 1,500 corporate training partners to 4,700 academic partners, three times the scale in just 2 years. It is currently set to become the biggest reach driver of their now profitable business. Lutz did not leave debate to chance. He knew that while creating a debate is easy, creating a rigorous, productive debate requires a deliberate approach. The three practices of the debate maker. In our research, we found that multipliers did three specific things very differently from diminishers when it came to decision making. While diminishers raise issues, dominate discussions and force decisions, multipliers, one, frame the issues, two, spark the debate, three, drive sound decisions. Let's examine each of these in more detail. One, frame the issue. Research showed that the debate makers know that the secret sauce of a great debate is what they do before the debate actually begins. They prepare the organization for the debate by forming the right questions and the right team and framing the issues and process in a way that everyone can contribute. The process is broken down below. Define the question. Tim Brown, the chief executive and president of IDEO, the famously innovative global design consultancy firm, said, quote, "As leaders, probably the most important role we can play is asking the right questions and focusing on the right problems. It's very easy in business to get sucked into being reactive to the problems and questions that are right in front of you. It doesn't matter how creative you are as a leader and it doesn't matter how good the answers you come up with. If you're focusing on the wrong questions, you're really not providing the leadership that you should," unquote. Multipliers use their own know-how to shape the way people look at issues. They have the ability to frame the questions in such a way that nobody else would have thought about. They shift through a variety of factors to identify the right issues and spend time formulating the right questions. Some of the questions include, unearth the challenge and challenge the assumptions that entrench the organization in old patterns and thinking. Surface the fundamental tensions and trade-offs to be considered in a decision. Force people to examine the facts and confront reality. Ensure multiple perspectives on an issue. As Tim Brown said, the right questions aren't the kind of lying around on the ground to be picked up and asked. The work of the multiplier is to find the right issue and formulate the right question so others can find the answers. Form the team. Multipliers ensure a great debate by having the right people in the debate. Potential candidates for a great debate include those with knowledge or insight needed to inform the issue, key stakeholders for the decision, those with responsibility for driving the outcome of a decision. In future shows, we're going to be looking at more details of the debate maker. For example, how to assemble the proper data, how to frame decisions, how to spark debates, how to create safety for best thinking, how to demand rigor in debate, and so on. So there's a lot of very interesting information that's going to be looked at here, critical for people who want to be debate makers within their organizations. So please stay tuned for future shows.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
CJSF Radio Simon Fraser 90.1 FM.
So sun rahe ho CJSF 90.1 FM, jo ki Burnaby, British Columbia, which sthit hai. This episode.